Mr. Templeton Vane, welcome. Any friend of Lady Welly's? You are just in time for tea, and you must join us.
With that, he manoeuvred us into the sitting room, with all the bouncing enthusiasm of a border collie, darting here and there, gathering cushions and making introductions. He was not a tall man, being only of middling height and rather broader about the waist than he might have liked. But there was power still in the heavy shoulders and arms, and his eyes were bright with a lively intelligence. His hair was abundant, but closely cropped and iron-grey. His beard was the same, but his brows still showed dark, black slashes against the sunburnt skin of his face, set above eyes of an indeterminate colour. In all, he gave an impression of great vitality. His enthusiasms would be infectious, I realised, and his energy difficult to match.
"This is my wife, Lady Tiverton," he told us, as the lady in question rose gracefully from a chair.
As Lady Welly had suggested, she was dressed in grey, expensive and austere, the only note of colour coming from the brilliant green of the winged scarab brooch pinned at her throat. Her complexion, unlike her husband's, must have been well guarded from the fierce Egyptian sun, for it was smooth and unroughened, and only slightly darker than a typical English woman's. Her hair was a rich black, parted severely and winged back from her brow, untouched by even a thread of silver, and I judged her to be her husband's junior by at least a quarter of a century. Her expression was one of such calm serenity in contrast to her husband's that she might well have been a ghost. But then she smiled, a smile of such arresting sweetness that all thoughts of spectres were banished. A greater change from her husband could not be imagined. If he was champagne, full of fizz threatening to escape the bottle, she was a delicate liqueur, subtle and languid. She moved to greet us, extending her hand.
"Miss Speedwell, I am pleased to make your acquaintance."
Her voice was low and gentle, and I wondered if she cultivated it to calm her rumbustious spouse. "And I yours, Lady Tiverton," I said, shaking the pretty silken hand. My own was work-roughened from solvents and glues and various tools, but she was courteous enough not to flinch. Suddenly a creature darted from behind her skirts, snuffling enthusiastically at my hand, and Lady Tiverton laughed.
"Please excuse Newt, Miss Speedwell. I am afraid her manners are not what they should be."
It was a dog, but unlike any dog I had ever seen. Of medium size, with a sleek, muscular build, it had enormous bat-like ears that stood perfectly upright, giving it a quizzical expression.
"Newt?" I asked,
giving the name the same inflection her mistress had.
"Yes, but spelt N-U-T,"
the lady told me.
"She's very like the dogs painted on Egyptian tombs, don't you think? It seemed only fitting to give her an Egyptian name. Nut was the goddess of the stars. She attaches herself to whoever is nearest the fire, or the biscuit barrel."
She warned me with a smile. The dog thrust its head under my palm, demanding a pat, and I obliged. Lady Tiverton clucked her tongue, and the dog turned back to her, settling itself on a cushion in front of the fire.
"I hope that you will forgive the intrusion," I began.
Lady Tiverton's calm eyes, dark as a midnight sea, widened.
"Oh, you must not apologize. My husband delights in visitors,"
she explained fondly. Her gestures were languid as she resumed her place on the sofa while Sir Leicester bustled about, indicating chairs and ringing for tea, as unruly as his wife was unruffled. She turned to Stoker.
"Mr. Templeton Vane, are you connected with the Viscount of the same name?"
"My elder brother, my lady," he told her. "Do you know him?"
She gave a little laugh.
"We do not move in such exalted circles, I am afraid. We spend all of our time either in Egypt, at the digs, or our home in Surrey, cataloguing the finds.
Hence the hotel,
Sir Leicester said aggrievedly.
A man ought not to live in a hotel if he can possibly avoid it,
he pronounced.
There is little domestic joy to be had when one is not under one's own roof.
His wife smiled. So exacting in England. But you should see him in Egypt, happy to live in a tent and eat his supper from a tin can.
We were all happy to live in tents until you came along, said a disembodied voice.
Stoker and I turned in our chairs to see the draperies parting. Concealed in the window embrasure was a girl, the famous Figgy, I presumed. She was, as Lady Welly had suggested, 15 or so, but wearing a thoroughly unbecoming dress of a shade of green that made her look like a bilious cat. The sleeves were puffed, the skirts ruffed, and the whole effect was unfortunate. She was dark, like her father, with strongly marked brows and a decided nose. Perched atop was a pair of spectacles, the lenses smudged and greasy. As Stoker rose, she came forwards, a book clutched in her hand, and I could just see from the cover that it was one of H. Rider Haggard's more spine-tingling tales.
My stepdaughter,
Lady Tiverton murmured by way of introduction.
Iphigenia.
Her father gave her a reproachful look.
Now, Figgy, don't grumble. You know things have been much more comfortable since your stepmama took over the domestic arrangements.
The girl looked scornfully at Stoker.
Why are you standing?
It is considered good manners to stand when a lady enters the room,
he told her gravely.
Well, I am not a lady, and I was already in the room, so it's rather silly of you,
she said. To his credit, Stoker grinned.
Quite right.
You have a patch on your eye. Are you a pirate?
Nothing so glamorous,
he assured her. He flipped up the patch to reveal his eye, as healthy and wholesome as the other.
I merely wear it when my eye is fatigued.
How did you come to get those scars?
She inquired.
From an uncordial jaguar in Amazonia.
Figgy's eyes shone with interest.
Did you kill it?
Regrettably, yes. But I'm afraid the fellow left me no choice.
Did you shoot it? I would have shot it,
she said stoutly.
I was unarmed at the time,
he replied, his lips twitching in amusement.
You killed it with your bare hands? That is the most thrilling thing I have ever heard. Was it difficult? What did you do with the skin of it?
Lady Tiverton interrupted with a small, patient sigh.
Figgy, we were just about to have tea. I asked earlier if we might have some of those little cakes you like so much.
Cakes?
Figgy Tiverton rolled her eyes heavenwards.
I am not a child to be bribed with cakes.
Her father gave a snort of laughter.
Not a lady, not a child. What are you then, Fig?
He laughed uproariously at his own joke, and I conceived in that moment a thorough dislike of the man. 15 was a precarious age, and she wore it awkwardly. Having a stepmother as serenely unflappable as Lady Tiverton could not have helped matters, and her father was wholly insensitive. But Stoker was not. He indicated his chair.
If you please, Miss Tiverton, I cannot sit until you do. My old nanny would hunt me down and whip me if I tried.
Figgy Tiverton's eyes rounded as she swept her gaze along the 6 feet of Stoker's height and across the breadth of his shoulders.
She would have to be a very strong nanny.
She was,
he told her, the corners of his mouth twitching. Something in his unlikely charm thawed her a little. She did not take his chair, but settled herself on a hassock by the fire as Stoker resumed his seat.
The dog, Newt, lifted its head and laid it squarely upon Figgy's lap. I was glad to see at least one creature in the family liked the girl. Tea was brought in then, and we passed a convivial quarter of an hour in drinking and eating. Sir Leicester was devoted to the cherry tarts, while Lady Tiverton toyed with a slender sandwich. From her perch in front of the fire, Figgy toasted several muffins she did not eat. Stoker discreetly helped himself to the pile, muffins drenched in butter being one of his favourite things, and I permitted myself a piece of chocolate gâteau that would have put the Earl's cook to shame. One of Lady Welly's protégés had been employed at the Sudbury as a pastry chef, and I made a note to send my compliments. The conversation was general and pleasant, covering travel and butterflies and books, until we brushed the last crumbs from our lips just as the door opened.
"Have I missed tea?"
A young gentleman with a comely face and dark ginger hair entered. He had Stoker's years but not his inches, being very slightly shorter and leaner. I had once compared Stoker's physique to the glorious fallen angel painted by Carbonell. In contrast, this fellow was a slimly muscled Botticelli saint. He moved with the loosely knit grace of an athlete, a fencer, perhaps, and he gazed at the assembled party with a genial expression.
"I didn't realize we were having a party,"
he told Lady Tiverton in a tone of apology.
"I would have worn a nicer tie."
She gave him a motherly smile.
"You look quite presentable, Patrick. Miss Speedwell, Mr. Templeton Vane, this is Patrick Fairbrother, our expedition philologist."
She completed the introductions, and Mr. Fairbrother shook my hand, bowing slightly from the neck.
"Speedwell, I just read the most interesting piece on Saharan swallowtail butterflies, rather a new discovery if memory serves,"
he began.
"I don't suppose you are any connection to the author?"
"Yes, I wrote it," I told him. "It was most exciting. Papilio Sahari was only catalogued by Obertur in 1879. I find the yellow and brown coloration most interesting, given the fact that it is endemic to North Africa."
"Exactly. I confess I am no expert on lepidoptery, but your description of the creature was absolute poetry," he said. "Did you know that butterflies feature in some of the tomb decorations of the pharaohs?"
"I did not," I admitted.
"Oh, yes. Some scholars believe the motif was used as a means of illustrating the Egyptian belief in resurrection. It is an obvious parallel with the butterfly's own metamorphosis, is it not?"
"It is. What do other scholars believe?"
"That butterflies found their way onto the walls of the tomb simply because they are beautiful,"
he told me, his eyes never leaving my face. I realized then that he held my hand still in his, and I withdrew it gently. He blushed, the delectable rosy shade to which ginger-haired complexions are often prone, and swiftly made his greeting to Stoker, who returned it with cool indifference. I was interested to note Figgy regarding him with a look of adolescent loathing. If he noticed, Mr. Fairbrother was immune.
"Save me any muffins, Figgy?"
he asked her cheerfully as he seated himself.
"Only one. Choke on it and die,"
she said, tossing the breadstuff. It landed, buttered side down, on his lap, and he shied. Figgy laughed, the first genuine expression of pleasure I had seen out of her since our arrival. Lady Tiverton pressed her lips together in a line of disapproval, but Sir Leicester merely joined in her laughter.
"Figgy, you are such a pip," he told her.
"Figgy was badly spoilt," I corrected silently. But I turned instead to Mr. Fairbrother.
"What, precisely, does a philologist do?" I inquired.
He paused a moment to retrieve the muffin from his trousers and drop his handkerchief discreetly over the butter stain. I knew exactly what a philologist did, but it had long been my experience that most men love nothing better than to talk about themselves. So I kept my mouth shut and my eyes wide as he launched into a lengthy explanation of his duties and fed bits of the buttered muffin to Newt, who gazed at him in rapt adoration. When he finished his little monologue, I made suitable noises of appreciation. "How fortunate for you to be part of such a successful expedition," I told him. "Was it your first trip to Egypt?"
"It was my second, actually, and I certainly hope it was not my last," he replied.
"Then you'd better find a new digestive system," Figgy warned. "You spent half the season in the privy."
Mr. Fairbrother blushed again, but before he could react, Sir Leicester bellowed,
"Iphigenia!"
Her father had at last reached his limit. He straightened in his chair, his colour nearly apoplectic.
"If you cannot act like a lady, you will remove yourself to your room."
"Gladly,"
she said, rising from her hassock. With grave courtesy, she handed the toasting fork to Stoker.
"Good afternoon,"
she said politely, inclining her head with all the imperiousness of a duchess. The dog Newt rose and followed her, ears pricked like a crown.
"Good afternoon, Miss Tiverton,"
he said, rising once more to his feet and giving her a little nod of salutation. Mr. Fairbrother kept to his chair, ducking his head and reaching for a sandwich as Lady Tiverton offered us a wan smile.
"I must apologize. My stepdaughter is a trifle high-spirited at times."
"Like a purebred filly,"
Sir Leicester said with grudging approval.
"Although I thought she would have learned a little better to behave in company by this time."
"She only wants understanding,"
Lady Tiverton told her husband.
"She wants whipping,"
her father countered swiftly.
"But I've never had the heart to do it."
"Her resentment is natural,"
Mr. Fairbrother said quietly.
"She feels I have usurped her place, and I cannot blame her for that."
"Patrick!"
Sir Leicester's voice was sharp, but Fairbrother merely waved a reassuring hand.
"She feels displaced by my very presence, and why wouldn't she? You have taken me in and treated me like a son. If I were Figgy, I'd do far worse than put a frog in my bed and oil of figs in my soup."
"Did she really?" I asked. Patrick Fairbrother's smile was wry and entirely charming.
"The oil of figs, yes. I cannot prove the frog. It might have hopped in of its own accord. It was Egypt, after all."
I grinned in reply. Sir Leicester made a sort of tutting sound.
"Listen to us, running away with ourselves. You've no interest in our little family dramas. You've come to hear about the curse,"
he said, giving us a knowing look. He held up a hand.
"I do not blame you. It is the story of the decade, of the century, perhaps. Where would you like to begin?"
He looked from Stoker to me, and I smiled sweetly.
"With the disappearance of John de Morgan."
Sir Leicester's florid complexion suffused with red, but Lady Tiverton was more composed. She made a sympathetic noise.
"Such a dreadful business. I am very sorry for Mrs. de Morgan. At least, I would like to be."
"You suspect her of aiding her husband in the theft of the diadem?" I suggested.
"Not a bit,"
Sir Leicester said.
"My husband and I are not of one mind,"
Lady Tiverton explained. Sir Leicester shook his head.
"I will not have such stories put about,"
he said firmly.
"We've no proof Caroline de Morgan is complicit in the theft."
Lady Tiverton's gaze rested indulgently on him.
"My husband will not admit that ladies are capable of villainous acts,"
she said. "But you will?" I ventured. Her expression was serious.
"I have seen enough of the world to know that women can scratch and claw and fight just as fiercely as men for what they want. Perhaps more."
"Indeed," I said. But Sir Leicester shook his head again, like a grizzled lion shaking off the buzz of an unpleasant idea.
No, Mrs. De Morgan is worth our pity for her husband's actions, but not our suspicion,
he insisted. You are certain, then, that John De Morgan stole the princess's diadem? I asked. Lady Tiverton gave a firm nod.
Of course he did.
Her husband did not appear as certain. His look was distinctly uncomfortable.
Careful, Poppet. We don't want to open ourselves to libel.
Lady Tiverton's little sigh seemed tinged with exasperation, but she concealed it well.
I think you mean slander, my love. But it is difficult. We know what we believe. However, speaking it openly is, as my husband says, a dangerous thing. And the police simply do not seem to care.
She added, spreading her hands. They were long and slender, unadorned save for a slim gold ring upon the fourth finger of her left hand. What have they told you? I asked. Sir Leicester puffed himself up again.
Precious little! The Dover police were less than useless. They mishandled questioning Mrs. De Morgan badly. They sent out notices to the ports, but what does that do for getting back my crown?
He demanded. Lady Tiverton put a quelling hand to her husband's arm.
Scotland Yard seemed to have given up, she said simply. Mrs. De Morgan refuses to speak with them further, and she cannot be compelled. Of course, the Metropolitan Police cannot spare the men to watch every port. There are far worse crimes than the theft of a single jewel. Ours must seem like a very frivolous sort of crime, the loss of a crown. What is that compared to the murders and assaults they must contend with daily?
Put like that, it seemed entirely reasonable that Scotland Yard would have thrown up their hands after a cursory investigation. Stoker, who had remained silent during our conversation, suddenly broke in.
What about you, Mr. Fairbrother? Do you think De Morgan and his wife stole the diadem?
Because he was startled at the abrupt inquiry, Mr. Fairbrother's hand jerked, spilling watercress into his lap.
Good gad, he said with a rueful laugh. That's two butter stains in a quarter of an hour. These trousers will never come clean.
He lifted his head.
Apologies, ladies, for the language. As to your question, Mr. Templeton Vane, I do not know what to think, except that it is certainly incriminating that the fellow disappears at precisely the same time as the most valuable jewel in the tomb goes missing. Whether his wife aided or was his dupe cannot, in the end, matter. The fact is, John is gone, and so is the diadem, and the police are doing precious little to find either of them.
Lady Tiverton broke in.
Perhaps you would like to see the diadem.
She rose and went to the writing table, carrying back a portfolio.
We have a sketch of it. We would have preferred a photograph, but I am afraid Mr. De Morgan was not an experienced photographer. There were few usable plates from his work.
Lady Tiverton opened the portfolio and extracted a large sheet of paper.
Why so? I inquired.
Trouble with the equipment. Exposed plates. Missing chemicals. It's a miracle we got any plates at all,
Sir Leicester said.
To what do you attribute the troubles?
Stoker inquired. Patrick Fairbrother spread his hands in an expressive gesture.
No one knows, but the locals said it was the handiwork of the mummy of Princess Ankeset.
The curse, I said, taking the page from Lady Tiverton. I held it so that Stoker could examine it at the same time. The drawing was well executed, tidy and draftsmanlike, with strict attention to detail and no flourishes, save a gentle wash of colour where appropriate. The diadem of the Princess Ankeset of the 18th Dynasty was written in neat capitals at the bottom, along with the date of the find. but it was the jewel itself that demanded our attention. It was a slender crown, graceful in its sinuous curves. A circlet formed the base, and an arch of gold ran from the foundation at the center of the back to the front, ending in three sculpted golden animal heads, a vulture flanked by gazelles. A series of stiff ribbons fashioned from gold hung from the circlet. Along the length of one ribbon, a cartouche had been engraved, a long oval surrounding a group of hieroglyphics, the lady's name and titles, no doubt. And the whole crown was fitted with jewels. Below the drawing of the diadem, a brief paragraph described the gems as carnelian, jasper, and lapis lazuli. "The vulture is the goddess Nekbet, who spreads her wings over Upper Egypt," Lady Tiverton explained, "while the gazelles were symbolic of Anuket, goddess of the cataracts of the Nile. Taken together, the crown symbolizes the protection of the source of the Nile, the foundation of all life in Egypt. Our princess was a very high-ranking lady indeed." "It is spectacular," I told her truthfully.
"And priceless,"
Sir Leicester said, rubbing his hands fretfully.
"Of all the pieces he might have taken."
He let his voice trail off suggestively. But I understood. All those years of digging in Egypt with half-hearted results, only to strike gold, quite literally, in the form of a princess's tomb, and then to have the most precious object taken from it. It reminded me of the time my net split, just as I brought it down upon a Rajah Brooks birdwing in Sumatra. It was the first and only time I ever encountered one in the wild, and I mourned for it still. The blow of losing the coronet must have been a serious one to Sir Leicester, and I felt an unexpected rush of sympathy for him. I said as much, and he was silent a moment, clearly caught in a reverie. His wife gave a gentle cough, and he shook his head, recovering himself.
"Oh, yes, as you say, quite a blow indeed, but not as serious as losing the mummy would have been," he added swiftly. "Nothing matters as much as the princess herself."
He nodded to the closed door behind him, and Stoker and I exchanged glances.
"You have her here?"
Stoker asked.
"I certainly do. I wouldn't even let her be shipped through a commercial line with the rest of the grave goods,"
he said, with a touch of proprietary pride.
"I brought her privately out of Egypt. She travelled with us every step of the way from Cairo to Dover, and she will not be out of my care until her sarcophagus and all her treasures are displayed next week."
He rummaged through a sheaf of papers on the blotter on his writing desk before thrusting a piece of card at us. It was an invitation to the Tiverton exhibition at Karnak Hall on the 1st of March. The exhibition would feature the finds from Princess Ankhesset's tomb, highlighted by the displaying of the lady's sarcophagus. A note at the bottom indicated that admittance was by invitation only.
"You are both welcome to attend," he said graciously. "We have chosen the most auspicious date for the affair, the 1st of March, known to ancient Egyptians as the going forth of Khepri, the date when the scarab god rolls forth the sun and all is reborn. It will be quite a spectacle. Once the private exhibition is finished, we shall open the collection to the public for a short while, before the artifacts are to be offered for sale,"
he explained.
"It will give the common man a chance to elevate his entertainments."
I deliberately avoided Stoker's gaze, but I suspected he was repressing laughter. Sir Leicester was the oddest mix of bombastic high spirits and good cheer. Compared to the cool serenity of his wife, he seemed an elderly schoolboy.
"This exhibition will be my crowning achievement. Lady Tiverton is even writing a book upon the subject,"
he added, with a warm look of marital pride at his wife. She put up her hands.
"Oh, no, you mustn't call it a book,"
she protested.
It is only a little pamphlet upon the history of the 18th dynasty, a sort of introduction to the period for those who are unfamiliar with it. It will be a modest effort at best, nothing like the scholarly books written by the first Lady Tiverton. She finished. I held up the invitation card with a smile.
How very kind of you to invite us. I was not certain how we would be received today, given our current task, but you have been nothing but gracious, Sir Leicester.
Current task?
Lady Tiverton asked quickly. I held the smile as I turned to her.
Yes. You see, we are investigating the disappearance of John de Morgan.
Making a dramatic pronouncement is akin to pitching a stone into a still pond. There is silence, but the ripples are perfectly apparent. Sir Leicester's dark gaze rested upon us, the eyes narrowed suspiciously.
Lady Welly's letter of introduction said that you were interested in Egyptology.
Lady Welly's relationship with the truth is better described as a nodding acquaintance in this case, I told him. Mr. Templeton Vane has an interest in discovering the whereabouts of Mr. de Morgan. If anyone can ascertain the truth, he can.
Templeton Vane, Lady Tiverton said slowly. I knew I recognized the name. Now I remember.
Her voice trailed off.
Yes, I am also Caroline de Morgan's former husband,
Stoker affirmed.
All the more reason to take an interest in her welfare,
Lady Tiverton said, giving him a consoling smile.
It is a credit to your gentlemanly instincts that you intend to learn for her what happened to her present husband.
Before I could point out that Stoker's motivations were rather more self-interested than that, he gave her ladyship a gracious nod.
As you say. But while we may have inflicted ourselves upon you under less than honest pretenses, certainly you can appreciate the merit of having this little mystery cleared away.
Little!
Patrick Fairbrother's hands were fists upon his knees.
If you can locate John de Morgan, it will be a greater find than Princess Ankhesset's tomb.
Sir Leicester nodded slowly.
Yes, I have to agree with Patrick. We would like to know what became of John.
And recover the princess's diadem, I added. To his credit, he did not protest.
Certainly. I will not balk at the truth, Miss Speedwell. I have written off de Morgan as a common thief. And if I never see the fellow again, it will be too soon. But I would very much like to have my diadem back.
I smiled. Then we are natural allies. If we find de Morgan, no doubt we shall find your crown, and we shall do our best to recover both, I promised him. Now, is there anything you can add to what we have already read in the newspaper accounts? Sir Leicester's mouth thinned.
You've seen the Daily Harbinger, then? Preposterous twaddle, all of it. Concocted by that blackguard J.J. Butterworth, whoever he might be. The mummy's curse, indeed.
But the story of the curse has kept your expedition in the public eye, I pointed out. Naturally, that will drive interest in the sale of the collection. His expression was stern.
My dear Miss Speedwell, one does not sell pieces of a collection like this for the purposes of making money.
He bit off the last word as if it tasted bitter. I flicked a glance to Patrick Fairbrother, who was pointedly saying nothing. Sir Leicester went on.
One sells only to kindred spirits, to those who have not the opportunity to travel to Egypt to excavate, but who live and breathe antiquities as we do. The interest of the general public is something we do not court.
He finished loftily. Patrick Fairbrother ate the last of the sandwiches.
Apart from the accidents and the misfortunes we have endured, it is a thorough nuisance, this curse, he said. It is the entire reason we left Egypt so early. The tale of the curse began there?
Stoker inquired.
It shouldn't have,
Lady Tiverton said quickly.
Excavations in Egypt are arduous things. There are always complications, illnesses, accidents, delays. But this particular expedition seemed to have more than its fair share, and unfortunately, the mummy itself seemed to supply a reason.
Patrick Fairbrother leant forwards.
You see, the tomb we discovered is not intact, and it does not even belong to Princess Ankeset. To be strictly correct, it isn't even a tomb. It is a sliver of a cave, and nothing more. Usually, Theban tombs in the Valley of the Kings are elaborate affairs, with many chambers below ground, properly excavated from the rock and highly decorated. It takes years to prepare a royal burial properly. But Our Lady was discovered in a very small natural cave some 40 feet above the nearest ledge.
How on earth did you manage to find her? I asked. It must have been like stumbling over a particularly elusive needle in an Egyptological haystack. Sir Leicester preened a little.
I was an accomplished climber once upon a time. I still like to keep my hand in, so to speak. The cliffs around the Valley of the Kings are treacherous beasts, crumbling and unsound. But I am careful, and I do like to get a bit of exercise. I happened to be climbing in a remote area of the valley last year, a spot no one had ever excavated before. I stumbled upon what I thought was a mere crevice in the rock. A cursory glance showed that it was actually a proper cave, albeit a very small one. It occurred to me that it was the perfect sort of place to cache a hoard of goods. I poked my nose in a few inches and found a bit of pottery. Just enough to convince me I was right.
Last year? I asked quickly. Lady Tiverton took up the thread of the story.
You see, each expedition is granted a firman, or permit to dig, and it specifies where one is allowed to excavate. My husband was climbing on the very limit of the perimeter of our firman, so when he discovered what he thought was a possible find, naturally, we said nothing at first to the authorities.
For fear it was not within your rights to excavate.
Stoker finished. Lady Tiverton nodded.
Exactly. To all outward appearances, the impression in the rock was just a cave. But the pottery shards persuaded him that it had been put to a far more interesting use, she said, darting him a quick look of pride. We studied the charts and maps and realized the tomb lay just outside the permitted area for us to dig. Without official permission, we would have no claim to anything we excavated in the tomb.
So you applied for permission to dig in the area where you already knew there was a tomb?
Stoker asked. Lady Tiverton's smile was gentle.
It sounds dreadfully underhanded, but it is common practice amongst Egyptologists. Everyone has their pet theories as to where something wonderful may be found, and everyone jockeys for permission to dig in their likeliest spots. We were terribly lucky. The tomb is located in a particularly remote wadi or canyon. No one else was interested, so we had no competition for a firman. We returned to dig this season with great hopes of what we might find.
And you found a princess, I observed.
By the grace of God,
Sir Leicester said with fervor.
As Fairbrother said, the tomb was unfinished. The roughest sort of cave. Completely lacking in decoration. And she was crammed in there like so much wool in a bag. There were grave goods from at least 7 other burials as well.
How do you account for that?
Stoker asked.
I thought Egyptian royals were buried with their own possessions. In theory, they were,
Fairbrother explained.
Ideally, each member of the royal family would have his or her own tomb, a suite of rooms elaborately decorated and furnished with everything they would require for the afterlife. But rock-cut tombs are notoriously difficult to create. As I said, they take a long time, and unfortunately, death doesn't wait for everyone. Many royals have been discovered stuffed into someone else's tomb, rather like sharing your granny's crypt at Highgate. He finished with a grim smile.
Sir Leicester nodded thoughtfully.
Another complication was the existence of grave robbers, even in antiquity. No sooner were the tombs sealed by the mortuary priests than someone would come along and bash them open, looking for gold and despoiling the mummies. To prevent this, some mummies were removed from their tombs with as many of the grave goods as the priests could haul. They were stashed wherever space could be found.
I have heard of such a thing, I said, recalling some vague mention of a hoard of mummies being unearthed some time before. I mentioned it, and Stoker nodded.
1881,
he said.
People were still discussing it when we were in Cairo the following year. A whole family of royal mummies had been unearthed near one of the villages in the Valley of the Kings.
Deir el-Bari, Lady Tiverton supplied. Near the necropolis of Thebes, they were discovered by a particularly accomplished clan of grave robbers from the village of Gurneh, the El Rasul family. The fellows had been discreetly removing grave goods and selling them on the antiquities market, until suspicions were raised. The cache was investigated, and the entire tomb cleared immediately to put a stop to the illicit trade.
But where did they come from? I asked. Sir Leicester shrugged.
No one knows. The original tombs were never discovered. But at some point, millennia ago, the priests tasked with guarding the bodies of the pharaohs feared for their safety, so they removed them. We believe the same thing happened to our little princess.
Do you know who she was? Anything besides her name? We turned as one to Patrick Fairbrother.
I have deciphered every marking upon her sarcophagus, but aside from her name, there is precious little information of any use, except the curse,
he said with a slow smile. There is, actually, a curse upon the sarcophagus. I could not conceal my amazement. I had thought it some invention of an enterprising newspaper reporter.
Oh, yes, and rather a good one.
He drew in a long breath, clearing his throat. When he spoke, he intoned slowly, in a deep, stentorian voice, quite unlike his usual tones.
Cursed be those who disturb the rest of the daughter of Isis. Death will come to the despoiler on the wings of the vulture, and Anubis shall feast upon his bones.
Just then a log collapsed in the fireplace, sending up a shower of sparks. And in spite of the warmth of the fire, I shivered. At Fairbrother's pronouncement, Lady Tiverton's hand had gone to her throat, fingering the scarab brooch.
"Are you quite all right, my lady?"
Stoker asked gently. She nodded.
"Yes, quite. Only, hearing the words, spoken aloud like that, it makes it so easy to believe.
Rachel,
her husband said, frowning slightly. Believe what? I said, ignoring the baronet.
That Anubis really has come for us,
she said, her voice almost inaudible.
What makes you think Anubis has come?
Stoker pressed. Lady Tiverton lifted her head, leveling her sorrowful dark gaze.
I have seen him.
Chapter 6. If Fairbrother's pronouncement was dramatic, Lady Tiverton's simple statement was utterly chilling. Had she wept or wailed, it would have been far easier to dismiss her words as the ravings of a madwoman. But I had seldom seen a more self-possessed lady. She spoke calmly, with perfect composure, and from the lack of surprise demonstrated by her husband and Patrick Fairbrother, it was apparent they had heard the story before.
"When did you see him?" I demanded. "Where?"
"In Egypt,"
she replied promptly.
"I sometimes have trouble sleeping when we are excavating. It is so terribly quiet there, you see. No city traffic or muffin men or church bells to break the peace. Only that great, desolate silence, like a living thing. And then the jackals. They make quite an eerie sound when one is not accustomed to them."
She gave a rueful smile.
"I was brought up in Egypt, but in the bustle of Cairo, not the barren wastes of the Valley of the Kings. It is quite the eeriest spot I have ever been. When I am wakeful, I always rise and potter about, trying to do something useful. I find it makes me more inclined to sleep when I return to my bed. One night, as I fixed together a few pieces of pottery, I heard a jackal. Not uncommon, of course, but this one was very close to the expedition house. I was wondering whether I ought to rouse my husband to order the guards to shoot it. I looked out the window to see if I could determine how far away it was, and that's when I saw it. Him,"
she corrected.
"Anubis?"
Stoker asked gravely. She nodded.
"He was simply standing in a pool of moonlight. I could see him as clearly as if it were day. The profile of the jackal's head atop the body of the man. It was a mask of sorts, like the ancient priests would have worn. They fashioned such things out of cartonnage, and wore them during sacred rites. I knew what it was, and yet I cannot describe the effect of it. It was otherworldly. His chest and legs,"
she colored slightly at using the word,
"were bare. He wore sandals and a sort of breastplate of beadwork with a traditional linen kilt. Really, he looked just as if he had stepped from the wall of a tomb, a funerary painting come to life."
She finished. "And you could tell nothing else about him from his physique? His mannerisms?" I asked.
"What sort of question is that?"
Sir Leicester demanded.
"Do you think my wife is in the habit of seeing men prancing about half-dressed?"
"Not at all," I soothed. "I merely thought that her ladyship might have seen something familiar in the way he moved, something that might call to mind an acquaintance with a penchant for practical jokes, perhaps."
"He did not move,"
Lady Tiverton explained.
"He merely stood there in profile, perfectly still, until a bit of cloud obscured the moon. It caused a shadow to pass over him, and when the shadow disappeared, he was gone."
"Gone?"
Stoker echoed.
"Without so much as a sound."
"I presume you looked for footprints?" I suggested. Sir Leicester nodded.
"Naturally. There were no traces of the fellow to be found. No stray beads dropped from his breastplate. No marks of his sandals in the dirt."
"But you believe in this apparition?"
Stoker asked.
"Of course I do. If my wife says she saw it, that's good enough for me,"
Sir Leicester replied stoutly.
"I saw it myself."
Patrick Fairbrother said quietly.
Several nights after her ladyship. It was the dark of the moon by then, so my view was not nearly as clear as hers. But there was no mistaking that profile.
Stoker steepled his fingers together thoughtfully.
Did anyone else see it?
Fairbrother shrugged.
Dozens of people. The fellow walked right through one of the villages of workers clustered at the edge of the valley. Whole families shuttered their doors and windows and refused to come out again until morning.
How dramatic, I murmured.
It was a damned nuisance, if you'll pardon my language,
Sir Leicester said.
After that, not a man from 50 miles around would work our site. I had to import fellaheen from upriver to do the job. And, of course, none of them know the first thing about proper excavation work. They made a ham-fisted business of it, destroying half of what they carried out.
He finished bitterly. That is why we were preparing to leave early, her ladyship explained. We simply could not manage a proper excavation with untrained workers, not to my husband's standards. We decided to empty the cave to the best of our ability and call it a day.
And there was Jonas,
Fairbrother said softly, looking at his hands. Lady Tiverton made an inarticulate sound of distress, pressing her lips together.
Jonas?
Stoker asked.
Jonas Fowler, the expedition director,
Sir Leicester said, the words coming quite quickly.
He took sick and died. It was not unexpected. The poor fellow had a weak heart. He'd been waiting to pop off for years. Everyone knew this was his final season, but he did hope to last to the end of it.
He stopped speaking, his mouth working soundlessly. Patrick Fairbrother picked up the thread of the narrative.
Jonas was a good old sort, rough in his ways. He liked living with the workers, eating their food and so forth. We used to joke that his constitution was as stout as a donkey's, but it was a hollow jest, as it turns out. He fell ill. He was unable to rise from his bed for several days, and then his heart simply gave out.
We hadn't the spirit to go on after that,
Lady Tiverton said in a muffled voice.
And without proper workers, it all just seemed so terribly pointless.
Of course, I assured her. It must have been a dreadful blow.
To Sir Leicester most of all,
Mr. Fairbrother said, giving his patron a generous nod.
His friendship with Jonas was of the longest duration.
Sir Leicester seemed overcome with emotion for a moment, and I hastened to change the subject from Jonas Fowler's untimely death. It seems curious that a single sighting of Anubis would put off well-trained and experienced workers to begin with, I began slowly. Her ladyship tipped her head.
Have you ever met the average Egyptian villager, Miss Speedwell?
I have,
Stoker put in.
Then you will understand they are unique. They might be touched by the modern world, but they are not of it. They live in the desert wadis, marking the seasons by the inundation of the Nile, just as their forebears have for millennia. They dwell, quite literally, amongst the bones of their ancestors. It is little wonder that they still believe, at least a little, in the ancient gods. Tell me the average English farmer would not tremble to see the green man in a forest glade.
She finished with a smile.
It's damned barbaric,
Sir Leicester grumbled. Her ladyship seemed to take no offence at this criticism of her countrymen. She merely gave her husband a look that was sweetly chiding.
You only say that because they inconvenienced you,
she told him.
You are the first to champion the Egyptian worker as a marvel of industry and courage.
Well, They are not shy of a hard day's work, he said grudgingly.
I cleared my throat. Presuming that Anubis, god of the underworld and keeper of tombs, was himself otherwise occupied, we may safely theorize that your visitor was simply a mortal man playing a prank. Now, it might have been just a bit of harmless flummery, but it threw your excavation into confusion just after you made a significant discovery. The timing of it strikes me as interesting. Can you think of anyone who might profit from your expedition being interrupted?
Such as John de Morgan? Stoker offered. That was my thought, Sir Leicester said quickly. And his disappearance only confirmed it. Trouble through and through, he was.
Possibly. I clucked my tongue. But why go to the bother of masquerading as Anubis if he planned to run away with the diadem? What purpose did it serve him?
To further confuse us?
Sir Leicester suggested. But he sounded doubtful, and Stoker shook his head.
Unlikely, I should think. I wonder, do you have any professional enemies? People who might have been jealous of your find and eager to drive you away from it?
Sir Leicester and Lady Tiverton exchanged glances with Patrick Fairbrother.
There is one,
Sir Leicester began. Lady Tiverton touched her scarab brooch again.
We have no proof, she murmured.
The blackguard threatened me in the lobby of Shepherds,
her husband blustered.
Horace Steele,
he said succinctly.
This has the stink of him all over it.
Horace Steele, the American millionaire? I asked.
The same,
Lady Tiverton confirmed.
He and my husband were excavation partners for many years. Last year's season was their final joint expedition.
What caused you to part ways?
Stoker asked Sir Leicester. The baronet shifted.
I wouldn't like to say.
Sir Leicester, I said in my most beguiling voice, surely you see that any information might help us understand John de Morgan's disappearance and recover your diadem? Perhaps Mr. Steele was involved. Lady Tiverton made a little noise of distress.
You mean to suggest that Mr. Steele might have bribed John de Morgan to steal the diadem, and then paid him to disappear? I cannot bear to think of it. It is horrid enough to imagine that Mr. de Morgan might have stolen the jewel for his own gain, but I could understand it. He has a wife to support, and limited prospects. The temptation would be too much, perhaps. But for him to succumb to conspiring with Horace Steele...
She let her voice trail off, pressing a hand to her lips. What can you tell us about Mr. Steele? I prodded. Sir Leicester exchanged glances with his wife.
As you said, he is an American, and a wealthy one. Doubtless you have heard of his businesses, mining, railways, steamships. He was a millionaire twice over by the age of 30. But what business acumen he has was acquired on the streets, as it were. He decided, after he turned 30, to remedy the defects in his education and took up the study of Egyptology. He had already established a name for himself in that field when my wife, my first wife,
Sir Leicester corrected with a hasty glance at the present Lady Tiverton,
began to publish her books. He was most impressed by them, and they struck up a sort of friendship. In due course, we formed a partnership and launched the joint Tiverton Steele Expeditions.
He fell silent then, his complexion warming, and Lady Tiverton spoke.
Mr. Steele was, for a very long time, a devoted friend to the Tivertons,
I am sorry to say that he never entirely warmed to my presence in the family.
Sir Leicester covered her slim hand with his own beefy one.
Damned fool!